ambiguity and distinction, historical, cultural dynamics.
When I started my work on ambiguity, I knew nothing about the power of the word ambiguity. There would be conferences where I would talk about my project and say the word ambiguity, and then hear it over and over again, traveling from mouth to mouth. This is ambiguous, people would say over coffee breaks and turn to me with a knowing smile, realizing that many things in conversations, interactions, and everyday life were in fact ambiguous. I would talk about my work with friends who would then come to me, show me text messages they got from their lovers and crushes, asking me what I made of their gaps and silences, of the questions they had overlooked or willfully ignored, the texts that they had sent and then deleted, read and not answered, or of that one cryptic emoji. What does it all mean? What are they really thinking? What do you read between the lines? Isn't this what you do? In conversation with a renowned scholar once, I mentioned I worked on ambiguity, and he replied, "Well, don't we all?" We do, and yet literary studies still lacks a coherent and ambitious methodology to read what books don't say, to see between the lines, to do justice to gaps, silences, things that pervade stories with uncommon strength but remain unsaid. In my field of research, which is early American literature, the need for such theory is particularly pressing. This is because, to borrow the words of Greg Danning, early America was a place of thresholds, margins, boundaries. It was a place of ambivalence and unset definition, multivalent and unending. In early America, the author's attempt to break through the confines of formulaic genres, the captivity narrative, the conversion narrative, the sermon, the sonnet, resulted sometimes in brilliant anomalies. What I want my project to do is to recenter our reading practices around these anomalies, these contradictions, these silences, this nothingness. I can think of no better example than a letter written in 1769 by an Narragansett convert, Sarah Simon, to her mentor, the missionary Eleazar Wheelock, the founder and co-director of Moore's Indian Charity School in Lebanon, Connecticut. The school's grand design was to educate Native Americans to become missionaries and teachers among their people. Simon begins by saying that she has been thinking about things of religion, and these do not look so plain to me as I have seen them. She laments having wicked thoughts that make her feel very bad, and turns to her mentor for advice. "It seems to me," she writes, "that true Christians never meet with such a struggle with Satan as I do. And so that makes me fear that I am a Christian because the devil is so busy with me more than he is with anyone else." This thought is apparently illogical. If true Christians never have to struggle with Satan and she does more than anyone else, this would mean she is no Christian or a lesser one. But she fears that she is a Christian because she has to struggle with Satan. Has she lost her train of thought mid-sentence? Transcriptions of the letter appear in 4 scholarly articles and books. And among these 4, only one keeps the contradiction found in the original letter and retains the sentence that "I am a Christian." If you look at the original letter, the article A was almost swallowed by a hole in the paper, but it is legible. The other sources, in what is likely to be an attempt to restore the logic of the passage, deliberately replace the article A with the negation "no," bringing Simon's thought back to hypothetical coherence, that "I am no Christian." If a Christian becomes no Christian and the ambiguity is obliterated, the text is less revealing of considerations that lie beyond words and paper. I believe the sentence, in its subversion of ordinary logic, paints an extraordinary picture of a troubled self. The inner turmoil caused by things of religion casts Simon in a state of confusion that breaks the structure of her writing. Consistently to what she announces in the beginning of the letter, that things of religion do not look so plain to me as I have seen them. Christianity seems to be one thing and its opposite. This ambiguity bears testimony to the painful condition and troubled state of mind under which authors of color wrote in early America, and in this case, to the grim experience that conversion and Christianization must have been for Native Americans. It is tempting to fill in the gaps and to provide closure where there is none, writes Adia Hartman. But assumptions regarding what Simon probably wanted to say, in quotation marks, erase unpredictable forms of expression that transcend the written word. How do we proceed then when we find ourselves in the presence of an ambiguous text? Imagine holding a firefly in your hands. Your hands should be cupped together to capture the firefly, but leave enough space between your palms so that you cannot crush it. Your hands need to provide a frame that allows the firefly to keep on flashing and you to take a good look at it, but it'll die if you hold it too tight, if you demand closure or strive for resolution. The sources straighten out the contradiction in Simon's letter, replacing A with no in the name of logic and consistency, crush the firefly and deprive us of the possibility to see the depth of Simon's confusion expressed to the failure of language, a colonial language, English, that she had learned later in life and wasn't perfectly literate in. The ambiguity in Simon's letter making things invisible to the reader that would not be otherwise. My project looks for such a frame. My name is Elena Furlanetto. I'm a postdoc within the research project Ambiguity and Distinction, Historical and Cultural Dynamics. I am working with Professor Barbara Buchenau on a sub-project titled Neophytes, Renegados, Creoles, Dynamiken der Desambiguierung in nordamerikanischen Diskussionen des Wandels vom Kolonialismus zur Nationalstaatlichkeit. I am writing my habilitation on neophytes, renegades, and creoles as ambiguated figures, but my research interests also include postcolonial literature, the representation of Islam in American media and literature, migrant writing, film, and poetry. That was it. Thank you for listening.